another in our series on legal ethics. Topic for this morning is the ethics of competing for clients. I want to thank Bayit Adult Education for co-sponsoring, as well as Jeffrey Silver for helping me out with legal research. Please make sure that you signed in on the sheets that are over there. That's especially important if you want to have credit. I want to call attention to something on the sign-up sheet just to make sure that it's clear, and if you need to correct something, you can always go over and correct it at the end. The sign-up sheet has a space for your name, and then it has a column for an email address to receive follow-up on this program, and then it has a third column, and that's to check if you want to receive the weekly email that advertises our general programs. That's not just the legal ethics, but programs in general. So if you're interested in being on the general free weekly email list, that's the column that you would check. If you please make sure that your cell phones are silent, that would be a big help. As you can see, this is also being recorded by video. It's also being recorded by audio. Technically, one can get credit also for watching or listening to the online archive. I don't really like to tell people that because, you know, that just means that they can watch it at home. Nonetheless, it's true. What's wrong with that, indeed? So the topic is the ethics of competing for clients, and in researching this, I saw this article in source number one, and I couldn't resist bringing it here. It's an example of do not try this at home. Defense lawyer causes stir with badly written letter promoting himself to accused killer. And this is just a piece out of the article. According to a document posted Tuesday on a listserv for members of the Criminal Lawyers Association, a national group with about 1,000 members, Mr. Leslie, he's the defense lawyer in this discussion, wrote Michael McGregor, the 19-year-old who, along with a 31-year-old woman, is charged with first-degree murder in the slaying of Sarnia, Ontario kindergarten teacher Noelle Paquette. The 27-year-old teacher went missing. Her body was found in a nearby wooded area outside town on January 2nd. By the very next day, Mr. McGregor was represented by a London, Ontario lawyer who was formally put on the record. So he has representation. On January 7th, Mr. Leslie was writing Mr. McGregor, modestly singing his own praises and offering his assistance. Mr. Leslie said he specialized in, quote, difficult murder trials and bragged in particular about two unique skills he said he possessed. One of the unique challenges in these types of cases is the question of how to control the press, he wrote. I have had several years of experience in dealing with the press. I had made close contacts with many reporters that I would endeavor to use to assist you in your case, he told Mr. McGregor. Mr. Leslie also bragged about his tremendous, in quotes, expertise in obtaining disclosure from recalcitrant Crown attorneys who don't provide it because, Mr. Leslie said, clearly meaning to say relevant, they feel it is not reverent. I have the resources and know-how to obtain all the disclosure relevant to your case and prepare the best possible defense available, he said, adding that in relation to your charge, I have worked on similar cases such as yours, I accept legal aid, and he goes on to say he also accepts collect calls and so forth. How many things are wrong in this picture with what Mr. Leslie has done? What has he done that he should not be doing? Okay. Well, right, for starters, contacting, these source sheets are over there. Contacting Mr. McGregor, and what's wrong with contacting Mr. McGregor? He's already represented. He already has a lawyer. Let's say Mr. McGregor had not already had a lawyer. So advertising is allowed. Is that the same thing as solicitation, necessarily? So we'll have to see, because that's actually part of this conversation. But I brought it more because it's a good example of how somebody can get himself into trouble. In this case, got himself into trouble in the press as his letters were leaked. But I bring three cases in source number two. The first one: Linda is pursuing divorce from her husband. Linda has legal representation, but she brings up her case in conversation with her neighbor, Susan, a divorce lawyer. May Susan promote her own services to Linda? What would you say? hear a no and a sure. The no is because already has representation. The sure is because they're neighbors. So why does being a neighbor allow her to bring up her business with somebody who's already being represented? It's an interesting question. Are the lines blurred by the fact that you have a relationship and you're able to have conversation? At what point are you going over the line? So that's the first vignette. Second one. Still, Linda is pursuing divorce from her husband. Linda has had a preliminary meeting with a lawyer, but she has signed no agreements. Linda brings up her case in conversation with her neighbor, Susan, a divorce lawyer. May Susan promote her own services to Linda? Yes. Why yes, as opposed to the previous case?
No obligation to the original lawyer.
She has no obligation to the original lawyer. So if we're talking about this from the law society's vantage point, I think there's a lot to be said for that. If we're talking about it from a Jewish ethics standpoint, though, this is going to require greater discussion. And then the third case, which, you know, maybe I added a little too much in here, but I needed to make the case convincing. Linda comes home from a business trip to find out her husband has pawned her jewelry to cover a gambling debt, which he had run up in trying to pay for a secret drug habit, which he had begun during a year-long affair with Linda's sister. Traumatized, she knocks on her neighbor Susan's door to ask if she could sleep there overnight. Susan is a divorce lawyer. May she offer Linda her business card? Sorry?
Why does Linda need the lawyer?
At the moment, she may not. But the what will be the issue?
Murder.
That's a separate discussion. If she offers her a butcher knife, that's a separate conversation. So this is something we're also going to look at this morning. The truth of the matter is that this issue is much simpler and I think more clear-cut. Not that particular vignette, but in general the discussion is much simpler than some of the other discussions that we've had over the last few years of legal ethics classes. But there are some interesting points that I think should be made. So as an introduction to this, there's a certain tension that the law society faces when it comes to regulating competition as it relates to advertising. We had a session at Shari Shamayim several weeks ago in which we talked about about ethical advertising. And there we introduced some of this. I noted there the source that I brought you on your sheets in number 3. From Chief Justice Nathan Nemitz, the Supreme Court of British Columbia, we have no doubt that the right to access to the courts is under the rule of law one of the fundamental pillars protecting the rights and freedoms of our citizens. The access to the courts, or access to justice as it's usually called, is considered an underpinning of society. We need to make sure that everybody is able to get a lawyer. And that's a concern when it comes to advertising, because if you were to say that you're not able to advertise, then how are people going to find out about legal services when they actually need them? Right? And this was one of the arguments that was brought back in the 80s and 90s regarding the liberalization of the rules regarding legal advertising. Part of it was for the benefit of the lawyers, and part of it was considered to be for the benefit of society. If lawyers can advertise, then people are able to find out about their services. The same concern, the concern for access to justice, making sure that people are able to find out about their options and that they're able to go to court, exists within the Jewish system. Granted that, as we've said on other occasions, there is no official position of lawyer in a Beit Din, in a Jewish court. The idea of, number one, the idea of having a lawyer is a very old one. The term Orech Din is already a term that exists in Talmudic times. That's the term we use today in Hebrew to refer to a lawyer. The idea of having somebody who would help make your argument is not new. But second, in general, the principle of access to justice, to make sure you can actually get to court and have your case heard, is of principal importance. If you take a look at source number 4, V'chi yagur itcha ger be'artzachem, the Torah says, when a stranger lives among you in your lands, lo sonu oso, do not abuse him. And it says, Kezrach mikem yelachem, he shall be as a citizen of your own. Hager hagar itchem, this stranger who lives among you. Ve'ahavtalo kamocha, you shall love him as yourself. Ki gerim ha'yisem be'eretz Mitzrayim, you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Ani Hashem alokechem, I am Hashem your God. You have a responsibility not to take advantage of the vulnerable, including the stranger. And this passage here, Leviticus chapter 19, Vayikra Yutes, talks about ways in which we are careful to take care of the vulnerable. And one of those is found in the next verse. Verse that I quote there from chapter 24, Mishpat echad yelachem, you shall have one justice for yourself, kager ka ezrach yeyeh, like the stranger, like the citizen. Everybody is entitled to the same access to justice and the same set of legal principles. Ki ani Hashem elokechem, for I am Hashem your God. And as the Midrash on that, the sages explain, the emphasis of I am Hashem your God in this context is meant to say, you often have people who are vulnerable within society and others are able to take advantage of them. And so therefore God is saying, I'm watching. Even if, as a member of society, you are privileged and this person is not, and therefore you're able to take advantage, you should know God is watching and He's going to make sure that that all scores are settled. Yes? Right. Correct. In the modern system, you have something that is called indeed a toein, and that's a term that is used not so much for someone who's a lawyer, not functioning in a way that's really parallel to lawyer in the secular system, but somebody who will help the litigant to be able to present the case in a way that's going to make sense and be compelling. So you're right. There's an aside from the orech din, which is more formal as a lawyer. Now, Toein is a little bit of a controversial position, just you should be aware. It's not straightforward that a court will necessarily accept Toanim, because Toanim are sometimes accused of being less than ethical in their design of the case. But yes, there is such a position. So, on the one hand, we want to make sure that there is advertising, and we want to make sure there's competition. We would like people, the lawyers, to be able to compete for clients, because ultimately, that will encourage greater access to justice. Anytime that you're competing with somebody else for somebody's services, you are more apt to do what that person needs and to reach out for that person's business. On the other hand, the Law Society is very concerned with the standing of the legal profession. As many, if not all of you, are familiar with, the laws until about 20 years ago were severely limiting in terms of what lawyers could do to advertise. Even today, there are certain limitations, not what once was, but you weren't allowed to advertise your services, and it was alleged that the reason for this was because of concern that in the event that people can advertise, one concern was that it will raise the cost of legal services because the lawyer is going to pass the cost of advertising onto the client. But the major argument that was brought was that it will result in dragging down the honor of the legal profession in the public eye. People will present their services the same way you present more mundane services. It will be a less elevated thing. And so take a look at number 5, which is from the Law Society's current edition of the Rules of Professional Conduct. It says, 4.1-2 is part of the general rules about advertising. In offering legal services, a lawyer shall not use means that otherwise bring the profession or the administration of justice into disrepute. And I heard somebody mumbling before when we were giving out the sheets that, you know, something along the lines of the cow is already out of the barn or something along those lines. No cynicism here. But the truth of the matter is that there was a study, which I quoted in the class on ethical advertising, there was a study done to see whether advertising brings down the public perception of the legal profession. The survey was done in the U.S., where, you know, advertising is much more prevalent and has been for a long time, and they discovered that people responded that advertising really wasn't what brought down anybody's opinion of the legal profession. Those who felt it was low did not feel it was low because of advertising they had seen on TV or in the paper and so forth. They had other issues. But here's an example of a concern for this. Take a look at source number 6. which I should note, goes back to before the lifting of the restrictions on advertising. This comes from a larger case, which I'm going to quote a little bit later on. It involves a lawyer from Ottawa by the name of Thomas J. Grace, who ended up being disbarred for a whole series of violations, but primarily most of the cases that are brought in this file, which is available at that link, most of the cases involve soliciting clients who already have representation. There was also the matter of taking drugs with some of his clients, which also is listed in the file, which he justified. He said he wanted to get to know the clients better and get to really see things from their perspective so that he'd be better able to defend them. That's something you probably shouldn't use as a defense. But take a look at number 6, which comes from paragraph 16. In November of 1988, the Law Society retained the services of Peter Campbell, investigator, to observe Mr. Grace's activities at the courthouse over a number of days. This is after they had received complaints from lawyers that he was approaching their clients. Mr. Campbell submitted a report dated December 5, 1988, in which he reports that on November 8, 1988, he attended at the courthouse and observed an accused by the name of Mr. Jean-Francois Zuger advise the court that he was unhappy with his solicitor and would be seeking a new solicitor. This took place in courtroom number 5, remand court. When Mr. Zuger left the courtroom, he was followed closely by Mr. Grace. Mr. Campbell observed Mr. Grace strike up a conversation with Mr. Zuger in the hallway and further observed the two, I assume that should be of, the two of them, then go to the cafeteria for coffee. Mr. Grace and Mr. Zuger sat together until approximately 12 noon. The court information indicates that on November 9th, 1988, i.e. the following day, Mr. Grace appeared as counsel for Mr. Zuger with respect to the charge. Now, this is brought as a complaint against him. What's wrong with what he's done? The fellow here, Mr. Zuger, yeah.
Zuger still has counsel. Zuger has not formally broken his tie with the counsel. The counsel has not informed the court that he no longer represents. So Zuger technically still has counsel. So therefore. Grace is poaching.
Right. So one way to look at it would be to say he still has counsel, although you've heard him say in court that he's looking for a new one. So I'm not sure actually how that works. Whether you really, once he has already said, I'm looking for new counsel, I'm not sure you can't approach him.
Yeah, but looking doesn't mean you found one. And saying
he's helping him in that regard.
No, saying that I'm looking for someone doesn't mean that he'll go home. And he'll ruminate on that and percolate and say, maybe I don't, maybe this. But he will talk with his lawyer and find out that, Zuger will find out that what he thought should have happened really is not in the realm of possibility. So he's still poaching.
Okay, so it's possible that it's considered poaching because he still currently has representation. I asked a few lawyers about this, and that's one possibility. What's another possible explanation for why this is considered wrong? Well, it's stronger. This goes back to the distinction that I was going to draw before. This is more than advertising. This is solicitation. You're actually going to him and saying, you need a lawyer. I am a lawyer. I would like to be your lawyer. That's actually direct solicitation of the client. The other possibility is that this is simply something that brings the legal profession into ill repute, in the sense that it looks bad. You have a lawyer who's hanging out in the court, in the courthouse and in the courtroom, in fact, looking for clients. That would be considered potentially, I think, part of what's listed in 4.12e, which we had in source number 5, bringing the profession or the administration of justice into disrepute. Yes?
I think there's also a problem here from the lawyer's perspective that's trying to solicit the client improperly, in that if they're receiving confidential information while this person has proper counsel on the record, they may be accused later on of having a phantom client, meaning that the clients who they were trying to solicit may come back later on and say, I shared information with you, you gave me advice, even though you're not on the record, and then you provided me in that little informal meeting with some advice, and I took your advice, even though you're not my lawyer on the record technically yet.
Right. So that's
so the potential malfeasant lawyer trying to solicit the client could be a phantom lawyer, and they couldn't get themselves in hot water.
Right. So that's a separate problem. Sorry.
That wouldn't be a breach of the rules.
No, no, I'm just saying.
Right.
Yeah, from a negligence.
Right. This could be another reason why what Grace is doing is a bad idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. He seems to, in general, have some judgment issues in his. We'll see more about his experience. So yes, the same concern, this concern that we're expressing here of bringing the legal profession into disrepute, is also seen within the halachic system, within the Torah system of courts and Torah scholarship. There's a great concern about Torah scholars holding themselves in a way that will bring their, quote, profession into disrepute. If you take a look at source number 7, I brought you perhaps the most famous example of this, passage from the Talmud. Rabbi Chiya bar Abba says, quoting Rabbi Yochanan, in the interest of time, I'm just going to read the English, but I felt it's important to have the original Hebrew as well on the sources. Rabbi Chiya bar Abba quotes Rabbi Yochanan to say, it is disgraceful for a Torah scholar to go to the market with patched shoes. To which they then explain, but Rabbi Acha bar Chanina actually went. How could that be? He went around with patched shoes. Rabbi Acha, son of Rav Nachman, explained the problem is with patches upon patches. It's a matter of degree. At a certain point, he has to make sure that he is going to be able to dress in a way that brings respect to that which he represents, to the Torah. And whether it's patched shoes or patches upon patches, either way, he has to make sure that he doesn't look that way in public. And then it follows with, Rabbi Chiya bar Abba quotes Rabbi Yochanan, saying a Torah scholar who has grease on his clothing is liable for death. That's not a literal death penalty. But they're quoting a biblical verse, a passage from Proverbs, from Mishle, which says, "Kol misanai avu maves, those who hate me, capital M, God, love death." And what the Talmud comments there is to say that don't read it as those who hate God love death, but those who cause others to hate God, those who cause others to view God in a negative way, those are people who love death, from which the Talmud says that the Torah scholar has to make sure that he doesn't have stains on his clothing. He finishes eating, he has to make sure that he either goes to the cleaners or that he ate neatly. So what we see in the preface here is, within the legal profession, you have a tension between wanting to make sure that you're providing services for everybody, that everybody has access to justice on the one hand, and then on the other hand, you want to make sure that the standing of the legal profession will remain respected. And within the Jewish system, you have this concept, the concern both for access to justice in a Beis Din and a Beit Din, and also concern for the proper respect for those who represent Jewish law. So this comes to a head regarding competition, and that brings me to our first case. The case which is colloquially termed scooping. To go after somebody who is already a client of another lawyer. And if you take a look at source number 8, you find the rule from the Law Society on this. 4.1-2D. In offering legal services, a lawyer shall not use means that are intended to influence a person who has retained another lawyer for a particular matter to change their lawyer for that matter, unless the change is initiated by the person or the other lawyer. Now that's the tricky part, going back to our previous discussion about the fellow who has already said he doesn't want his lawyer anymore. He has initiated something by saying he wants another lawyer, but he hasn't approached you yet. So I'm not sure how we'd view that initiation. But what he's saying explicitly, what we're saying here explicitly in the rules, is that you can't do something that is intended to influence somebody who has retained another lawyer. That's the basic principle. Yes?
So you hear, I've heard advertisements now that say, you already have a lawyer, we will give you a free second opinion.
Wow.
What do you think how
that sounds like a problem. That to me, I want to make sure I stress, because I didn't actually say it in the beginning. So I'll make sure to stress now. I am not a lawyer, and I do not represent the Law Society. So, get an opinion from someone whose word matters. But as I read both the cases that I've seen, which aren't that many. There aren't that many out there where someone's actually been brought up on charges for this. But from what I've seen, no, that shouldn't be okay. Yes.
If I go to an industry meeting and I present a paper outlining a result that I can achieve through a particularly creative legal process, I clearly intend to eventually get the people who are at the industry meeting to retain me for my services.
Right.
And my intention is clearly to promote myself and my business. Is that wrong?
Right. So that we're going to come back to in a few minutes, because that's the question of, again, advertising versus solicitation. So I'm going to come back to that, to the question.
I'm neither advertising nor soliciting. I'm just giving a paper.
Right, but it's a form of advertisement. Right? You're letting everybody know, I am a lawyer in this field who has a technique that other people don't have. So I would view it as advertising, but that doesn't mean that it's a problem. We'll see. Yes?
Last question. Let's say you have a lawyer and you're not happy with what he's telling you. And you go to another lawyer, you ask his advice on the same particular thing. Does that lawyer have the right to tell you advice knowing you have another lawyer? Because you've gone to him. Because you have second sentence yourself.
Right. So is this potential client actually asking for advice, which I'm not going to pay you for? So number one, that may raise the question that was raised before. That may raise the specter of the phantom client case, and you may get into trouble for giving him, you know, advice that he then relies upon.
But he is asking for a second. He's coming to you.
Yeah, and because he's coming to you, I think technically you're able to respond under this. I just think it may be a bad idea. There's no upside for you in this. Take a look at number 9, please. Number 9 is the case of James Bond, which I brought among the several from Grace's file just because I liked the name. But there are several like this in that file. On April, this is the same lawyer we discussed in number 6. On April 25th, 1988, Sharon Rosenberg made a written complaint to Mr. Michael Neville, president of the Defense Lawyers Association, with regard to an incident that occurred while she was duty counsel in No. 6 Court, guilty plea court, on April 20th, 1988. Ms. Rosenberg states that she was present in No. 5 Court, remand court, when an unrepresented accused by the name of James Bond advised the court he wished to plead guilty. He was subsequently transferred to the guilty plea court, where Ms. Rosenberg was duty counsel that morning. Subsequent to receiving disclosure, Ms. Rosenberg met Mr. Bond in the cell block at approximately 9:45 a.m., at which time he confirmed that he wished to be represented by her as duty counsel. So you have somebody who is being sent to guilty plea court. She is the duty counsel there. She meets with him, and he says that he wants her to represent him. Shortly thereafter, Ms. Rosenberg was advised by the assistant crown, Mr. B. Dandick, that Mr. Grace had approached him with respect to Mr. Bond. That, in other words, this fellow Grace has approached the assistant crown saying, I am going to represent Bond. Ms. Rosenberg advised Mr. Grace that she was acting as duty counsel and inquired as to when Mr. Grace had spoken with Mr. Bond. Mr. Grace responded that he was a friend of the family through his sister and that he was acting for free. When Mr. Bond was subsequently brought into the courtroom for plea, Ms. Rosenberg discussed the matter with him. Mr. Bond advised her that he did not request to see Mr. Grace, that his family did not know Mr. Grace, and that he still wished to be represented by Ms. Rosenberg as duty counsel. So, again, a fairly clear-cut case in which we see that no, scooping is not allowed. You can't do this. I mean, lying also is a bad idea. This is what we're talking about in number 8. There is an interesting nuance in number 10. And if anyone here is involved in this area of law and wants to comment on it, I'd be interested in hearing it. And this is from a document that the LSUC has put on their website called Ethical Issues and Practice Management. This particular paragraph is headed, whose client is it? The contracting firm / lawyer / paralegal's client, or the contract lawyer or paralegal's client? In other words, you have a firm that is, I don't know if you call it a firm or not, but they're called here a firm. You have a contracting firm which takes on clients and assigns them to a particular contract lawyer, somebody who's going to work on the case that as assigned by the contracting firm. And so the question is, when that individual lawyer is working on the case, is the client considered their client? If the contracting firm wants to swap them out and give them some other contract lawyer instead, is the contracting firm able to do that? Can they change this person's representation? Or do we say that is another version of scooping? You're taking them away. You're taking this client away from the particular lawyer. So in number 10, we're told, when the individual seeking legal services first retained the contracting firm lawyer paralegal, the individual became the contracting firm lawyer paralegal's client. However, during the time that the contract lawyer or paralegal provides legal services to the same individual, that individual is now the contract lawyer or paralegal's client also. In other words, it sounds like you can't swap them. They're now the lawyer.
Makes a difference. If he's paying directly to the contract firm, then it actually can change whatever they want. If he's paying the lawyer directly, then this would be correct.
Hey, the Law Society did not make a distinction in this page.
They didn't write it well either.
That's another question. But but it sounds like they're not able to do it regardless of who's being paid. That's the way that I read it. Anybody have knowledge, you know, from involvement with this sort of thing?
I think it depends on if the firm signs a retainer with the client, then it's the client of the firm, and they can sign whatever order
they want. Yeah.
That's what I would have thought, but as it's written, it doesn't sound like that. Yeah.
You have a number of problems here.
Yeah.
This is actually a very complicated question, and I just chaired a session for the Ontario Law Association with senior counsel from the Law Society. This is like the question of dual retainers. Whether it's implicit or explicit, you can have a dual retainer. When you have a client through one of these organizations, for example, you have potentially two clients, not just one. The person who's retaining you and paying you, in this case this other organization, and you also have a direct relationship with the person that you're actually representing.
Okay.
So you have a recipe for a conflict of interest, which is extremely clear here. You know, that you're going to have a problem if you do that. So the solution to that is to, at the outset, in your retainer, you have to make it very, very clear to the client to the person you're representing, actually, to make it clear as to who the client is and what your parameters of representation are and what happens. Because let's suppose, for example, that this firm says, okay, we're not going to pay you anymore, and the client is still coming to you for representation. You still have a continuing obligation, whether you're
right
or not.
Right.
This is a very difficult question, actually.
Interesting. So what they wrote here really needs some clarification. Okay.
Just on that note, though, isn't this, in this case, is it where there's only one client?
Yeah.
There's only one client.
That's why they're framing it.
There's possibly two lawyers. But the case that you were just referring to is a case...
Well, what he's saying is that even this case really involves two clients. They just didn't write it that way. But that, and it's logical. What you're saying is logical. In other words, the lawyer is being paid by the firm, and therefore he's their client, but he's doing services for the client, and therefore they're his client, I should say, the other way around. They're his client, but also this fellow is. No? Because...
Well, no, I was going to say, the lawyer is not a client. The lawyer is an employee of a firm.
Right.
You know, conditions of his employment.
Right, no, I misspoke. I didn't mean he was their client. They're his clients.
Yeah.
But that should apply in any case.
I think it's a problem if the lawyer is dismissed. I think that's where it depends what your retainer agreement says.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, the law firm is providing legal services.
Right.
So the lawyer, the contract lawyer is not an employer.
Yeah,
it's not
straightforward. Okay,
not
good. I'm glad to raise confusing questions. Yes.
I
was worried this was going to be straightforward.
I think in general, on the scooping issue, right, it's really, it's felt between lawyers, right, it's saying it's not how you should be drafting, and it looks bad. But it's really, it's not how you should be acting, not because of the impact on the client, but it will be that scooping lawyers offer better representation. The issue is really how the lawyers are interacting with each other, which is why people said firms should have terms of employment with their lawyers that say we can change out the representation of, you know, of her client. So
right.
Because you've been assigned to a file doesn't mean you're going to see it through.
Right. It's a good point, and I'm going to have to come back to that.
It always remains the client's choice whether they wish to continue to be represented by a firm or they wish to follow the lawyer.
Right.
It's always the client's choice. It's not the lawyer's choice.
Right, but in the following case, if your firm has rules for its employment of the individual lawyers, then the client, meaning customer rather than the firm, the client always has the option of saying, okay, you followed your rules, you swapped him out, I am now severing ties with the firm, and he's going to be my lawyer. That's fine. But then everybody has acted in an above board way.
Right.
You know, I think that is an important point, which we're going to come back to. It's going to be very relevant in the second vignette. Now, this issue of scooping is not only a law society concern, it's a concern within Jewish law. The term in Jewish law is in Hebrew, yored lumnaso shel chavero, descending into somebody else's trade. And I brought you source number 11. The Hebrew is the bottom of one side, the English is the top of the next side. This is a classic passage which really involves much debate, and I'm bringing one approach to it. Rav Huna said, if an alley resident establishes a mill, and when we say an alley here, what we mean is the following. The little bit about urban design going back a couple of thousand years ago. You had major thoroughfares, which was where the public market was and the major traffic was, and then you had streets that came off of those, and off of the streets you had courtyards. And the houses were all surrounding the courtyards. So what we're talking about here when I say an alley is a street coming off of the major thoroughfare. Often it was closed at one end. So you would leave the major thoroughfare, and then you would travel that closed street in order to get to the courtyards where the houses are. That's what we're describing. So Rav Huna says, if one of the residents of this side street establishes a mill, and then another alley resident establishes one nearer the sole entrance to the alley. So in other words, people who want to get to the existing mill are now going to have to pass another mill in order to get there. Right? And what's going to happen? They're going to go to the first mill. Why should I lug my grain to the second one when I can just get my business taken care of at the first one? So the former is legally able to prevent this, saying, you are interrupting my livelihood. You're taking away my clients. And this is brought as law in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law. If you take a look at source number 12, I give you an example of it. A teacher may not hire himself out to an employer who already hosts another teacher in his home, unless the employer tells him, I don't wish to continue to retain my current teacher, which, you know, think about it, has an analogous case in the discussion that we had before, about at what point you're able to approach. But this is the rule indeed. Now, there are some differences between when I brought you a number 11 or I brought you a number 12. Right? Case number 11 is not about soliciting the client. It's about positioning your business in such a way that you are going to take away business from him, even though you didn't approach any of the clients. There are other discussions about competition in terms of providing incentives to customers that are inappropriate and that sort of a thing. But I'm going to come back to the difference between positioning yourself well versus actually soliciting the client for yourself. I'm going to come back to that when we get to the second vignette. I don't want to get hung up on that difference yet. Yes?
The first thing applies to actually Eric is saying that plus rubber was the offense. Plus the rubber is the thoroughfare.
Yes. That's part of the discussion, but not as it relates to business.
The grosser schwaffers actually allow this, and this is a complete contradiction of the more. How can they allow this next to each other?
Right. So that's its own discussion. I'm not going to bring it in here because it's more complicated in terms of some of the nuances of the law than we need for this. But it's a legitimate question. But in terms of, yes, the paid internet advertising, you could make the argument that if I make sure that my site shows up at the top, then I'm also boxing him out, so to speak, in this regard. But we're going to see that that's allowed. So don't draw any conclusions just yet. There's some question as to why this isn't allowed. What is it within Jewish law, Jewish ethics, that says that you're not allowed to position your male ahead of his, or that you're not allowed to approach the client ahead of him? And there are different schools of thought. Maimonides writes, I didn't bring it on the sheet, but he writes in Hilchos Deos, it's the fifth chapter, he says that the way of Torah scholars is that, among other things, they won't do this. They won't approach somebody who already has a professional association with somebody else, and he doesn't mean in terms of Torah scholarship. He's saying that as an example of somebody who's supposed to meet a certain standard. It's a trait of piety that you don't approach people who already have another professional working for them. On the other hand, Rabbi Yosef Karo, who wrote the Shulchan Aruch, wrote the Code of Jewish Law, also wrote, before that, the work called Beit Yosef, and in Beit Yosef Choshen Mishpat Kufnin, but Kufnin Vav, he says it's a rabbinic prohibition. He says this isn't a biblical prohibition, this idea of competing with somebody in this way. It's rabbinic. And his basis for saying that is the fact that the Talmud, in the same passage as number 11, I didn't bring it on your sheet, the Talmud there says that there are exceptions to this rule. The rabbis allowed, where it's in the interests of the public to have these multiple businesses side by side, then it's okay. If there were biblical prohibition against such competition, then you couldn't waive it for anything. The fact that it's waivable suggests that it is rabbinic. But what I wanted to show you is source number 13, because that actually will be used to extend this to a biblical principle. According to our Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer. Source number 13 says, if you put somebody in a room and you lock the door so that he can't go to work, so you pay him for time lost from work. There are no other damages to be paid, but you pay for his time lost from work, what we call in Hebrew, sheves. In the same way that if I injure somebody and now he can't work, I have to pay him for time lost from work, among other damages. So too here, if you cause somebody to be unable to work, you're going to have to pay him for that. So based on that, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, Chasam Sofer, source number 14, wrote that this concept of yored l'umnusu shel chavero, entering somebody else's craft, entering somebody else's trade, he says, it appears to me this entire category is a biblical prohibition. It is full-blown biblical theft for me to take business away from somebody else. And he quotes you a verse from Deuteronomy, from Devarim, in which we are told that the instructions given to the judges, I instructed your judges at that time, listen between your brothers, judge justly between a man and his brother, and between the one who comes to live among them. What Chasam Sofer is doing, what Rabbi Sofer is doing with this passage and with the verse, is he says that the Torah actually presents an overall charge to society. And the overall charge to society is what you see there in the verse quoted in source number 14, which is to judge justly between a man and his brother and between the one who comes to live among them. Whether it's a stranger, whether it's family, doesn't make a difference. You have to judge honestly. And he says that is an overarching charge. And then it's up to the sages to figure out what it means and to apply it to particular cases. And that's what the Talmud is doing when it says you can't take work away from somebody else, even though you will not find a biblical verse that says don't take work. And some may quote the verses of Hasagas Gevul, but it's actually a separate category. He says there is no verse. However, there's this overall principle of carry out justice, and that's an application of it, not to scoop away somebody else's client. Are we clear? What I wanted to show here is that within the Jewish system, you have the same concept of not scooping, and that there's debate as to the level of authority that prohibition has. Is it simply a trait of piety, like Maimonides discussed, for the way people should conduct themselves? Is it a rabbinic prohibition, the way that Rabbi Yosef Karo understands it, with some degree of flexibility, where the rabbis decreed it, and they could also say it doesn't apply in other cases? Or is it even biblical, the position taken by Rabbi Moshe Sofer, to say that it's part of this catch-all biblical verse that charges people to judge honestly? All of these are potential explanations. Now, you have to ask the question the other way. If we're going to say that there's a prohibition against scooping, what is now the responsibility of the client who is being scooped? Right? Am I allowed, if somebody comes to me, I already have representation, and somebody comes to me and says, I will be your lawyer, I will do a better job, and so forth. And he's breaking the rules. From a Jewish ethics standpoint, he is breaking the rules. Am I allowed to hire him? From a law society perspective, the answer is yes. There's no rule on the client. The rule is on the lawyer. From a Jewish ethics standpoint, are you allowed to do it? It's an interesting question. So take a look at source number 15. Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau, who was a judge in religious courts in Israel until he passed away a couple of years ago. He says, some say that this type of competition constitutes theft, but the employer is not exempt from paying his salary, for he cannot recant in the middle of the job. He says, separate from that, the employer, meaning the client, can't just fire him in the middle of the job. The way that Jewish business law works is that employees are allowed to walk out in the middle, forfeiting the rest of their salary, as long as they don't harm the business by doing so, as long as they don't dismantle what they've already done. However, and there are rules that govern that. There's more to be said than that. However, when you look at it from the perspective of the employer is not allowed to dismiss the employee. You hired him. You promised a certain period of employment. That's what you have to fulfill. You know, unless he's harming your business, you're not able to walk out in the middle. So that the client is not necessarily allowed to violate those terms. Now, it could be that you could buy him out. You could say, there's some sum that I will give you, which is not the same as payment for the rest of the job, and that will cover my obligations to you. Or, alternatively, if you're living in a society that has a set of rules, we might argue that this is what we call minhag sochrim. This is what businesses do. And even if the argument will be made that within a pure Jewish system you wouldn't be allowed to dismiss him, nonetheless, since it's understood in the system in which we live that you do dismiss people midway through, maybe it would be allowed. Under that, under the principle of this is what everybody does, and therefore it was understood going in. What is clear is, even if you are able to dismiss him, he's going to be able to demand some level of payment within the Jewish system for the work that you are now taking away from him. There is a distinction between them. So that's a good question. There is such a distinction between what we call a poel, which is let me not make poel kavlan. There is a distinction between somebody who is an employee and somebody who is an independent contractor. However, fundamentally, what you're going to be governed by here are the terms that you set when you originally hired them. And if you said to them, I'm hiring you for the duration of this job, you're basically out of luck, whether we call him an independent contractor or we call him an employee. In that way, I don't think we'll see a distinction. Right. And it does, but I don't think it affects this particular aspect of it. That's the thing. We do have that in general. You know, can you tell him where to work, when to work, how to do the job, and so forth? Yeah. Right. But how will that affect your ability to dismiss him? Right, but so within the Jewish system, that distinction doesn't exist. The distinction of independent contractor and employee does have other ramifications in terms of responsibility for them, but does not, I believe, as far as this issue. Yeah, Chuck.
Mm-hmm. Still obligations that each party has to bring to the table. Is it the halakhic position that notwithstanding that the lawyer may not be providing the services in a timely, efficient, proper manner, it might get
Now, there is recourse for employers where the employee is not doing a good job. You're not locked into the person you hired because, you know, you hired him and now you're with them forever. So in the event that you can demonstrate that what he's doing was not what he was hired to do, he's not working up to the standard that was expected, then yes, then you're able to dismiss. Like every system, though, it's hard to prove things like this. That's true both Jewishly and secularly. One last point within this section, and that is the advertising question. So does this mean I'm not allowed to advertise if I'm going to draw away people? What about presenting the paper at the seminar? What about paying for a top billing on Google? Whatever it's going to be. So if you take a look on your sheet, you see two keynotes. One is source number 16, and this is a comment from Rashi in the 11th century, who talks about a case in which there was competition between people who came to town with goods, impinging on the market for local merchants. And in that case, they were allowed to sell their goods. So if you take a look at source number 16, Rashi explains why this was allowed, why it was okay for them to be able to sell their goods. He says, this was market day, when many came from elsewhere to buy in the market. Therefore, the townspeople cannot keep the merchants from bringing their wares and selling to those who gather in the market. If there is a concept of an open market, and today that's certainly what exists in our society, then there's nothing wrong with other people going out to market their wares. People are going to buy from whoever they want to buy from. But there is the option of advertising is there. That's point number one. And then point number two is brought by Rabbi Blau in source number 17, when he says, also dealing with the issue of advertising, he says, it appears that one may publicize that he works for good terms or provides better service and so forth. He's allowed to, and the key point, I actually should have brought more of this quote, is that it's not directed to this particular client. Now, when he talks about providing better service, that goes back to the question of what's considered appropriate advertising. Are you allowed to say, my work is better than others? The answer is generally no, from a law society perspective. But from a Jewish law perspective, that's not our concern. Once what you're doing is broad-based and not targeted to the fellow who already has representation, it's not your problem if the fellow who has representation sees your ad and says, you know, I like the way this lawyer looks, I think I'm going to go to them. That's not your problem. From a Jewish perspective, the open advertising is fine. That's again the distinction between advertising and solicitation. You didn't go to this person; you simply said, "Anybody who wants, I'm here." Okay, that's all under vignette one, which introduced us to the overall issue of scooping, both as it's seen now in the secular system and as it's seen in Jewish law and ethics. The question now of non-scooping is the interesting one to me. The one in which they're actually going to diverge between the law society's rules and the system of Jewish ethics for a reason that I find fascinating. Under the rules of the law society, remember vignette number two. Vignette number two was where the neighbor does not have representation yet. The neighbor had a conversation with somebody but made no commitment. And when I asked whether the neighbor is now allowed to give her a business card, the answer was yes. Because no commitment has been made. Under the rules of the law society, you're basically fine. The only thing you do need to know is that if you take over from an actual, from somebody's actual lawyer, I brought you a number 18, although it's not directly relevant to the case at hand, I wanted to find a place to mention it, and that is that the law society notes that if you take over from another lawyer, you do have an obligation to make sure, I shouldn't say it, that's stronger than what it says. It is proper for you to urge your client to settle all accounts with the previous lawyer. You should urge them to make sure that they settled up properly. That's a separate note. But under Jewish law, you may not be allowed to pursue this client this non-client. You may not be allowed to pursue this party once they've already had an initial conversation with the other lawyer. You may already be unable to continue. And the reason it comes under one of two headings. One heading is what's called in Hebrew, Ani Hamenakef Berosh Hazayis. Anybody ever see an olive harvest here? No one's ever gone olive harvesting. Okay. So then I can tell you whatever I like. No. The way the olive harvest worked historically, and it's not so different today, is that you would take sticks and you would bang the top of the olive tree, and the olives would come raining down, and you put your blanket or whatever it is underneath. They land on the blanket, and that's the way you get your harvest. Today they have machines that shake the olive tree, but it's still the same fundamental principle of harvesting by vibration. So the question is the following case. You have some guy who climbed the tree and is whacking at the branches and knocking down the olives. You come walking by on the road and you see a whole bunch of olives down at, you know, below the tree on the blanket. You say, "Thank you very much." And you walk away with the olives. He doesn't own them. There has been no formal act of acquisition upon the olives by the fellow in the tree. Under Jewish law, there are very specific ways you acquire things. You pick something up, you acquire it. He didn't pick it up. He just knocked the branch and it fell down. So take a look at source number 19. Passage from the Talmud, which says, if a pauper is striking atop an olive tree, taking that which is beneath him is theft. Why? Due to the ways of peace. You're right, legally he doesn't own the olives. We're still not going to let you do it. It's a rabbinic prohibition in order to pursue peace within society, and Rabbi Yossi says, no, I actually consider it to be theft. I think you are considered to be stealing from him. The issue fundamentally here is the strain of the person atop the tree. In source number 20, Rabbi Shlomo Luria, also known as Marshal, the Hebrew is on one side, the English is at the next side. He says, we must distinguish between one strain and another, for there are two types of strain. It's a matter of degrees, he says. There is strain that is entirely ineffective, and there is strain that, ineffective meaning legally, and there is strain that turns this into a rabbinically prohibited form of theft. It is not called strain unless one strains physically, in a visible way, like a pauper striking atop an olive tree. There is no greater strain than this regarding olives for which he endangers his life. He's climbed up to the top of the tree. So the point that Maharshal, Rabbi Shlomo Luria, makes here is, once somebody has engaged in strain, we are not going to allow you to take away the product of his work. Yes?
That's an odd question.
Good question. I'm going to come back to it. But yes, thank you for catching that, because it's going to be significant. It's not significant because this is limited to paupers. His question is, it says a pauper specifically. It's not going to be specific to paupers, but that word is going to matter. So the law will apply whether the person atop the tree is a pauper or whether the person atop the tree is a millionaire. It doesn't matter. I should also know, that reminds me, what we're talking about here is where the olive tree is not his property. This is an open, unowned olive orchard. In the event that it's his tree, the olives are indeed his, and taking away the olives is called theft. So that's not what we're discussing. This is this is some kind of a publicly available orchard, the likes of which probably wouldn't exist in our day. But that's the other question that goes with this is, so what's the penalty? You came along and you took the guy's olives. It's not really theft. So what's the penalty? Take a look at source number 21, Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, writing in the beginning of the 20th century. If another takes them, it is not fully theft, such that they could be removed via judges, where you could go to court. But he has sinned and he is punished by the laws of heaven. God's going to take care of things, he says. We don't have the ability in our courts. We don't have recourse. Because at the end of the day, it's not theft. He didn't own it. So therefore, we don't want you doing it, but we can't invent penalties. That's the first category. And then the second category. The second category is what's called in Hebrew, ani hamahapech b'charara, which means you have a pauper who is, and once again it says pauper, who is pursuing a charara. A charara is a cake that they, the way they used to bake it was with a coal to take it away from him. And then Rabbi Abba, he says, Rabbi Abba, well, you know what you did. And Rabbi Abba replies, I didn't know. I wasn't aware that he was going after the land. So what actually ends up happening is Rabbi Abba offers it as a present to Rav Gidl. Rav Gidl says it's a bad idea to take gifts. There's a verse that says, "Sone matanos yichya, one who hates gifts will live." So I don't want to take it as a gift. I'm willing to pay for it. He replies,
you know, it's a bad idea to sell your first portion of land. Your first entry into business, you're not supposed to sell that off. So I'm only willing to give it to you as a gift. I'm not willing to sell it to you. And he says, I don't want to take gifts. And the result is it becomes known as Ara Dirabanan, the land of the sages, and no one works the land. The land just sits there. With nobody working it. And again, if that story happened today, it's just how a developer would come along, and that would be that. But the point that I bring here from this passage is that if somebody is pursuing, the pauper is pursuing the cake, and somebody else takes it, he is identified as, in Hebrew, a rasha, a wicked person. Now, that's a very serious thing in Jewish law. That's not a minor thing. Calling somebody wicked is a very big deal in Jewish law. It's actually actionable in court. You could take somebody to court, to Beit Din, for calling you wicked. So on what basis would he be called that? Bless you. So again, there's a hierarchy of positions. One view is that it's a rabbinic statement. It's a rabbinic statement that if somebody takes something from somebody else, if someone takes something from somebody who is pursuing it, that is considered to be like an act of violence. In the same way that we are taught that if you raise your hand to strike somebody else, but you didn't actually hit him yet, that already makes somebody wicked, so to hear. Yes,
okay. Olives are going to be seen. It's not that we're trying to provide something for the olives, but in the case of a professional with a client is the object, and someone had started, professional A and started pursuing that client as the object, by saying, well, hey, that person is already pursuing stay away, seems to totally lose the interest of the client in that analysis, right? Like, what is best for that client? Maybe that first horse order isn't so great, and the client,
So Raquel points out that what we're doing by protecting, if we're going to apply this to law as opposed to olives, then what we're now doing is overbalancing on the side of the professional and against access to justice, fundamentally. So I'm going to come back to that point. It's a good point. I have to come back to it along with the proper note that was made as well. Hold the thought. But in terms of, yeah, Chuck.
I'd be interested in you addressing the scenario where a client is shopping and he meets lawyer A, and he likes lawyer A, but he wants to get the best lawyer for his file. So he sees, comes to you as a lawyer. Are you allowed to be obligated to say no since you went to the lawyer? I can't. Right.
So that's the logical next question, is what happens when the client wants to browse, right? Does that now mean that once you find out he's already gone to other people, you're now stuck and you're not able to, to have your hearing with him? Also part of what we need to address. Yes?
I think the other distinction that you need to make is you need to be able to see how much work has been put in by, in Chuck's example, lawyer A, right? In the olive case, he talked about the fact that the pauper put in a lot of work. He was banging all day on the tree.
Yeah.
The question is that the client may have met with lawyer A for 2 minutes. He may not have put in really a lot of work.
Right.
But in the pauper example, the guy was, banging on the tree all day. So.
Right. Exactly. And therefore, source number 20, which distinguishes between the levels of strain, I think becomes relevant. I think it does matter in terms of what did he do. Did he do a full workup of the case, or did he just send him a form thing that he sends to everybody who's interested in this type of work? Agreed. That has to be part of the calculation. I'm going to come back to more with this. I'm going to go a little bit further with this, and then and hopefully I'll answer some of the questions that are being asked. In terms of why he's called wicked, I gave one view that it's a rabbinic issue. There's a passage in the Talmud in source number 23. I'm not going to read it aloud, but you can see it there, where it's linked to a verse from the prophets that suggests you shouldn't do it. There is even a view, the Kesef HaKadoshim Choshen Mishpat Reish Lamed Zayin says it's about the verse, V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself. What you're doing by taking the business that somebody else had already worked on is a violation of the principle of love your neighbor. All sorts of arguments are made. Fundamentally, number 24, Rabbi Shlomo Luria tells us what the penalty is. He says, according to the view of the rabbinical court, they should be strict, as Rambam, Maimonides, rule. For the rabbinical court is empowered to be strict as appears appropriate in their eyes beyond the rule of the Talmud. In other words, unlike the previous case, right? The case of the pauper who is banging away at the top of the tree. In this case, he actually says, the courts should be strict in whatever way they deem appropriate, depending on how egregious this is. And so they're going to have to evaluate and decide what to do. But there's a key note, which I think matters a great deal when we start trying to apply this to law, and it's one that hasn't been noted yet. And that is, when we talk about the pauper pursuing the cake, what we're talking about is something that you can't find just anywhere. Free cake. Right? You can't just find that. Normally, you have to pay for it. And in this case, he's getting it for free. If you're talking about a product which is available anywhere, well, take a look. You can see how it's framed in source number 25, Rabbi Moshe Isserles brings it as law. He says, if one is acquiring something and someone else comes along and he can buy it for a low price, which you will not find elsewhere, it is like finding an item. Well, I'm going to have to say it outside of it. That wasn't as clear as I thought it was when I brought it on the sheet. If the item is only available here, if the item that we're talking about, the customer, the client, whatever it is something that's only available in this case, then I am allowed to pursue it because I am just as much a pauper as he is. It's only where you're talking about something that I could just go somewhere else to get. That's where we would say that this rule pertains. But the other point that was asked, the question was asked about what if the client wants to go from place to place. A lot of this is really about the perspective of and the expectations of the ani, the pauper who is involved. He got his hopes up. He invested his work in the olive case. Or in this case, he's running after the cake and he thinks he's going to get it. In the event that he knows full well from the get-go that this is an open market, that the client is expecting to go to multiple people and to see what they have to say, then this rule will not apply, this problem of taking away clients. Take it completely out of the realm of the law. I have a jewelry store, and someone comes to me and says, I went to that other jewelry store already. There's nothing wrong with me trying to sell him what I have in my store. Because the fellow in the other store understood. The guy is pricing things up, wants to see what the inventory is, and then is going to make a decision. Where it's understood that there are multiple options, then this becomes less of an issue. But what I wanted to pick up on in this is why the Law Society draws the line and says, only if they have an agreement with somebody are you out. Whereas the Jewish law system, or the Jewish ethics system that's driving the Jewish law, says that there's much greater protection for the existing professional, the one who already has something of a relationship. And the key is to pick up on what you mentioned before, which is the wording that's used. What is it called, the existing professional? What was the term that we used for the guy who already has the job or doesn't have the job? He hasn't, but he has been working at it. We called him a pauper. Right? He was the needy person. He was the pauper. The general Talmudic philosophy of business is different from the general secular philosophy of business. Generally speaking, in the business world, we say, you're pursuing a client, I'm pursuing a client, we're business people, this is what we do. However, within the Talmudic philosophy of business, a professional is somebody who sells his time and expertise in order to survive. And if he weren't needy, he wouldn't be selling his life for money. That's what he's doing. He's selling his life. He's selling his time. He's selling his know-how. He's selling his abilities for the sake of cash, for the sake of being paid. And we view him, therefore, as a needy person. And there's a lot of evidence for this in various texts. I brought you two from the Rambam, from Rabbi Moses Maimonides. Take a look at source number 26. He's talking about the levels of tzedakah, the levels of philanthropy. And Rambam, Maimonides, has eight levels of philanthropy. And the top one is the one that's in number 26. He says, the highest level of tzedakah, beyond which nothing is higher, is to give him a gift or a loan or create a partnership with him or provide him with work to strengthen his hand until he no longer needs to ask from others. Providing somebody with what we call a parnasa, providing somebody with a living, is the highest form of philanthropy. It's considered philanthropic. You're helping him out. It also shows up in source number 27. There's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. Pirkei Avot generally being a lesson in how a human being is supposed to conduct himself. So there's a line there that says, paupers should be members of your household. Yiyu aniyim b'nei beisecha, paupers should be members of your household. On which Maimonides comments that what it's teaching is not have an open house and let paupers come in. That may be a nice idea. But he says what it means is, when you're going to hire somebody to work in your household, it should be from the poor and indigent. Hire somebody who needs the job. The way that employment is looked at is a form of philanthropy. Because of this perspective, and it's far beyond this, there are many sources that I could have brought to support this, but because of this perspective, Judaism tends to give a greater strength to the person who is pursuing the job than the secular system does. The secular system says, we're not placing a value on that guy versus you. Everybody is on an even playing field. They can all pursue work. But we're looking at it and saying, no, the person who approached the client before and who made the pitch is a needy person, and therefore it's inappropriate for you to come take the job away from them. Jeffrey, and then, yeah. Right.
Is that a person entitled to the best legal advice or to a second opinion? Either a medical issue, but you want a second opinion or the best medical services?
Right. So this goes back to what Raquel had said before, that then you were overbalancing and now you've lost the access to justice piece of it. To which my answer would be, you can actually satisfy both. The way to satisfy both is to make sure that the person who's going to go around looking at multiple potential lawyers has to be upfront. So that this person doesn't get his hopes up and doesn't now expect, now I have money to pay for my kid's tuition, now I have whatever. Once he's been honest, I think that reduces some of your responsibility to cede the field to the previous lawyer. I think that's a key difference. Yes?
Perhaps I'm not reading this right, but, or understanding right, but if the person pursuing, lawyer A who's in pursuit is like a huge law firm with thousands of clients, and person B, lawyer B, is a simple sole practitioner, are you saying that that's less of a problem in under halacha than the converse?
So that is exactly what I would suggest. Based on what we saw in source number 24, where Rabbi Shlomo Luria said the court is going to handle this based on its based on what it sees to be involved in the particular case. It's based on whatever they see here. He actually didn't write based on the case. He said as appears appropriate in their eyes. But yeah, I think that it will depend on how egregious this is. How much harm are you doing to the other party?
So, but I mean, the entire principle of law of Jewish law is that you don't look at the plaintiff in front of you, whether he's a doll or whether he's an usher. Like, you have one English spot for everybody. So
correct. One law for everybody, but when your law is, don't harm the needy. If this person isn't needy, then he doesn't fit under under this. I mean, that's part of why this is viewed as rabbinic, is because it does have some degree of flexibility in terms of its application. This isn't like a case of straight theft. So I think that may be why. Moshe, you had a question.
I think actually has more than everything you've said. I'll give you a very good example. That's the intent of your client themselves. The complete intent. Now, there are a number of clients, this is a fact, that go to a number of different lawyers, law firms, give them an hour, which they pay for an hour, to make sure the other side can't use these law firms of conflict of interest. I know tons of people do it. Their intent is basically go as many lawyers as possible so the other side can't use them. It's worth a half an hour to pay the law firm, just not that they can't use conflict of interest. In that case, right. 100% has nothing to do with it. The intent of the client is only to hire them.
Right.
He knows hiring them just for that half an hour.
Interesting.
To make sure the other side can't use them.
Interesting. So that may well be an issue in a, you know, from the secular perspective. What I'm trying to show you, though, from the Jewish ethics perspective, is that we're looking at it from the lawyer's perspective and his feelings, so to speak. But that's a... The example he gave was of clients who, or not clients, they're not clients, but people who will go to a law firm, hire the law firm, sit through a meeting with them, only so that that law firm will not be able to then litigate their case later on because it will be a conflict of interest. That's the example that he gave. However,
because
I think you have to remember
that. Because it's law board, I'm involved in that case right now where the other side is retaining
Right. No, it's not just right. The tactic makes sense. The third and last case is the one that's most simple, but I wanted to make sure to mention it, and that is the vulnerable client. Source number 28. In offering legal services, a lawyer shall not use means that take advantage of a person who is vulnerable or who has suffered a traumatic experience and has not yet had a chance to recover. If the prospective client is vulnerable or has suffered a traumatic experience and has not yet had a chance to recover, and it's expanded on in source number 29 by the commentary. A person who is vulnerable or who has suffered a traumatic experience and has not yet had a chance to recover may need the professional assistance of a lawyer. And this rule does not prevent a lawyer from offering their assistance to such a person. A lawyer is permitted to provide assistance to a person if a close relative or personal friend of the lawyer contacts the lawyer for this purpose, and to offer assistance to a person with whom the lawyer has a close family or professional relationship. Right, going back to my case, the next door neighbor is a divorce lawyer. If she says to her, I need a divorce lawyer, then it would seem she'd be able to respond. The rule prohibits the lawyer from using unconscionable or exploitive or other means that bring the profession or the administration of justice into disrepute. It looks like you are trying to take advantage of the person who's in this position. That's where you get into trouble. I should note, this is not about the client making bad decisions. That's a separate issue. If you take a look at number 30, I brought you a separate rule under the category of mandatory withdrawal. Subject to the rules about criminal proceedings and the direction of the tribunal, a lawyer shall withdraw if the lawyer is not competent to continue to handle the matter. In other words, this isn't saying don't pursue vulnerable people because they're going to hire you when they should have hired somebody else. That's not what we're talking about. That's already no good under 3.7-7. You can't take on a client if you know you can't serve them properly. What we're talking about here is you could serve them properly, but it doesn't look right for you to talk to people who are clearly in a vulnerable state, wait for them to recover. And there we say, in the event that you have a relationship, it doesn't bring the legal profession into disrepute, then it's another story. That's what the Law Society is saying. And Jewish law, as we've already said, has no concern for, or has limited concern for, I should say, appearance of the profession. We have some concern about how Torah is presented, and therefore in a baked-in position in a religious court, there may be some concern about how you approach people. But our fundamental concern is only going to be, does the client have a chance to make a proper decision? And so I brought you here source number 31, the biblical verse, do not put a stumbling block before the blind. And that we apply, as noted in the Midrash, in source number 32, the Midrash I brought you there, that putting a stumbling block before the blind includes giving somebody bad advice, advice that is self-serving. I know that he has a field, and I want the field. I'm going to tell him, oh, you know, you should sell off your field and buy a donkey instead. You know, that sort of a advice, that self-serving, is inappropriate. That we do have as a concern. The concern for the reputation of the profession is less of an issue for us. So what I hope people come away with from the discussion, and please, if you didn't sign in the beginning, please make sure you sign in, especially if you want credit. We had a case that came up with CME. We do credit for doctors also for continuing education, and we had a situation in which somebody came and didn't sign in because their spouse had signed in, and we still aren't able to give them credit for it because we need to know that you were here and we need the record of it. So please make sure the sign-in sheets are over here on the table. but what emerges here is a basic tension from the law society's perspective. We want access to justice, but on the other end, we're concerned about the standing of the legal profession and the result what could result from close competition and taking people away from those who are already serving them. Scooping, we said, where you go to somebody who already has representation, is clearly a problem from the perspective of the law society. We noted the complication, which really requires further research on the issue of the contracting firm and who exactly is the client or who are the clients in that case. From a Jewish law perspective, we said you're not allowed to compete with somebody else for their livelihood, and we said that the client may be allowed to hire a new person, but may be required to pay the salary of his original employee, in this case, the original lawyer. We do allow open advertising. From a Jewish law perspective, it's an open market. Everybody understands that they're in this competition together, and it's not targeted to this particular client. In the case of non-scooping, where there is no formal agreement between parties, that's where the two systems diverge, where the law society will have no problem, it appears, whereas the Jewish system will say, you're still not allowed to pursue where somebody else has invested effort, unless everybody involved knew that they're going to multiple parties, in which case it's less of a concern. And we said Jewish law is more demanding in this regard because it views the professional as a needy person, and you're taking away from a needy person who already invested in this opportunity. The last point was the vulnerable client, and we said, yes, the law society is very concerned about the profession and says that even if you're good for this person, you still shouldn't approach them at a time when they are vulnerable unless there's an existing relationship. And from a Jewish law perspective, we're less concerned about the appearance of the profession. If you're good for this person, then it's appropriate. If you're not good for them, then you should not approach them. And I'm going to now turn over the floor to my friend Jerry Belitsky, who's going to make an announcement. And our next session is going to be, I believe, at Shari Shamayim in May. I'm blanking now on what the topic is. Anybody remember offhand? If you're on the email list, then you're going to get the notice for it, but I believe it's at Shari Shamayim in May.